KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Welcome to The Menu on Native America Calling, our special feature on Indigenous food news. I'm Andy Murphy. Native spearfishers still face harassment and intimidation by non-Native people more than 30 years after the violent protests of the Walleye Wars. Ojibwe spearfishers have fishing rights in ceded territory. And tribal and Native food programs are scrambling after the Trump administration canceled federal funding. Join us after the news.
This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull, sitting in for Antonia Gonzalez. This Friday, a special event is being held in Anchorage that'll bring together former boarding school students, researchers, and others for a day of remembrance and reflection. Called Moving Beyond Boarding School Summit Towards Truth and Healing, the event will be moderated by National Native News' anchor, Antonia Gonzalez. For her, the issue strikes home.
My mom went to boarding school hundreds of miles away, having her mouth washed out with soap for speaking her Navajo language, going there and experiencing the trauma of having to cut her hair, which, you know, in Native culture is a big thing with her long, beautiful hair. And she tells stories of just how traumatic that was.
The Alaska Native Heritage Center and Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, which owns National Native News, are co-hosting the event. While members of the press are welcome to attend, recording will not be allowed for a four-hour block in the afternoon.
We do have people who are going to be in attendance who are traditional healers, culture bearers, elders, so there are a lot of people there to offer support, but also to allow people space so that they can feel like they can share openly.
The boarding school era is a painful one for many Alaska Natives and Indigenous communities. Both government-run schools and those operated by churches work to remove Native culture and practices, and accounts of physical, emotional, and sexual abuse have surfaced in the years since they operated. Skin sewing or hide sewing and beadwork are vital art forms in Southeast Alaska's Tlingit culture. Rain Pavlik of Yakutat in rural Alaska is blending those art forms with contemporary style. As Alaska Public Radio's Cadence Cedars reports, Pavlik sees it as a way to resist the pressure on Indigenous artists to modernize their work.
Rain Pavlik sits on a bed next to a large collection of her latest work.
It required a lot of tedious line work.
There's a pair of jeans with sealskin flare, a woman's suit made of deerskin and seal hide, and many of the pieces include ornate beading.
Beading a straight line is really hard.
She holds up a pair of hand-sewn moccasins.
So this pair of moccasins is made with deer and moose skin.
She turns them over, revealing beadwork on the back. The letters read, "Land Back," in an old English typeface.
Which is a message for the world we live in today. And so
Pavlik says she grew up in Yakutat, surrounded by artists. She says she first learned from her mother how to sew items like pillowcases. The few members of her family practiced skin sewing on animal hides like moose and sea otter. So Pavlik learned from her aunt.
Making moccasins really was a way to connect to my family and my ancestors.
Now Pavlik's community knows her for her beadwork and skin-sewn garments. She says her art is inspired by her Tlingit heritage.
Using the traditional materials and using it in a modern way feels like I'm honoring my ancestors, but I'm also modernizing some of the ideas that people have attached to traditional materials.
She tries to only use materials from donations or thrift stores.
It's something that our ancestors would do, is they'd use what is near us, and so I felt like that was a good way to honor them.
And next, she says she wants to explore new ways to pass on her skills to the next generation. In Anchorage, I'm Cadence Cedars.
And on this day in 2019, Stanford University's Sarah House was renamed after Carolyn Lewis Atneve, a member of the Delaware tribe. She was a globally recognized scholar and psychologist who was seen as a major figure in creating the field of Native American mental health. This is National Native News. I'm Brian Bull.
National Native News is produced by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support for this program provided by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, the business, the tribes, and the communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Support for law and justice-related programming provided by Hobbs, Strauss, Dean & Walker, LLP, a national law firm dedicated to promoting and defending tribal rights for over 40 years. More information available at HobbsStrauss.com.
Scoop Dash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods, tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Om Yeh.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
This is The Menu on Native America Calling, our feature on Indigenous food sovereignty. I'm your host and producer, Andy Murphy. During the first 100 days of Donald Trump's presidency, tribes and Native programs that rely on federal resources and funding have had to contend with funding cuts and program eliminations and the resulting uncertainty. Food programs like the Food Pantry, operated by a nonprofit on the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation, will have to continue their work somehow without their $750,000 grant that the USDA just canceled. Dozens of other tribes' USDA funding for purchasing local foods was also canceled. We'll hear more about that later in the hour, but first, Ojibwe spearfishers are reporting incidences of harassment and intimidation as they exercise their treaty fishing and hunting rights. It's an ongoing problem held over from what was known in Wisconsin as the Walleye Wars more than 30 years ago. You can join our discussions today by calling 1-800-996-2848. What are the food distribution and treaty rights discussions going on in your community? That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us from Minocqua, Wisconsin is Greg Biscacone Johnson. He's a tribal fisherman and a culture and language instructor. He's Lac du Flambeau. Welcome to The Menu, Biscacone.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. I'm glad you could join us. So you had an experience while spearfishing for walleye the other day. Can you tell us what happened while you were out on the lake?
Yeah. So me and my spearfishing partner, we were out on the lake, and what happens is the creelers on the landing, they give us a permit, which allows us so many fish per lake. So we got our permits. We went up to this one area, and we got all of our walleyes. And on our permits, there was a few muskies left. So we decided to go into these bays where these big houses were. Some are, they call them cottagers around here. We went by these cottagers' houses in front of their houses on the lake, and we were spearing muskies. And just as we were leaving this one bay, after we got one really nice muskie, we heard gunshots behind us on the hill. And this isn't the first time that's happened to us. So that's becoming a common thing during our spearfishing, spring spearfishing time.
Mm-hmm. How do you know those gunshots were directed at you or a message to you and the other fishers out that night?
Well, it's that nighttime, and usually when you hear high-powered rifles, a majority of the population, especially up here, hunting season is in the fall, and when you hear a rifle like that, that was distinctively a high-powered rifle. So that's how we know. That's how we know it was used as an intimidation thing. You never hear gunshots unless natives are out on the lakes trying to provide for their families. That's usually when you hear that type of stuff. Unless it's fall season and there's hunting going on, but, you know, obviously nobody hunts at night. So.
Mm, okay. So what is the permit process like, and who oversees that?
So we have this program that our tribe is banded with called Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, and so they kind of oversee population estimates, and they issue permits to member tribes. And what they do is they'll go out in during the spring, and they'll do what's called shocking, and they get fish counts on these lakes, and so that's what helps them determine the numbers that we can harvest. And so when the lakes become there's a certain temperature that they get to, it would trigger the spawn of the walleyes. And so once that happens, they issue permits on certain lakes. And, you know, some lakes might have 300 walleyes that are harvestable. Some may have 25, 30. It all depends, you know. And there's a safe, allowable catch, a safe, allowable harvest limit that all of our tribes, we try to utilize. So there's no overfishing. There's also stocking programs as well.
Okay. And you mentioned before, you know, you only hear gunshots when natives are out on the lake. What other instances of intimidation or harassment have you experienced over the years?
So just a few, probably about 4 years ago now, there was an incident on the lake about a mile from the one we were previously discussing here. It was called Little St. Germain Lake in northern Wisconsin. And me and my crew, we went out there, and we got to the landing, and my motor man says, "Which way do you want to go?" I said, "Don't go right, because last year I got threatened over there. Let's go left." And it was the first house that we approached, and the intoxicated cottager started yelling, and then he started shooting at us. And so we took off across the bay, and we called the authorities, and they arrested him. And he went to jail that night, but I guess he got released because, you know, they say that word is that he knew the sheriff and he knew the judge. And what wound up happening is later on the court case came up, and he wound up only paying a $300 fisherman harassment fine, and he had to write a letter to a public apology letter. That was a request, and that never materialized. So when these incidents happen, you know, they stir up a lot of controversy about, you know, treaty rights and the misunderstanding of the non-native population that exists here.
Right. And this is all sort of left over from the walleye wars. I mean, has it been getting this harassment, has it been getting worse or better over the years since?
Yeah, you know, I think with the current administration, a lot of the people are bold. They, you know, what they do is they feel safer, you know, holding their guns and doing all this crazy stuff. You know, it's, you know, with this administration, they really push self-defense and, you know, all these crazy ideas, you know. And so I think what happens is these people that have these guns, you know, they come out and they say, "All right, well, you know, this is my property, so I'm gonna, you know, try to stop this." And so they're kind of shielded under that, you know. That's what we're sensing, and we're getting back from that side of the fence. And so, this is becoming a more common thing. Just a few nights prior to us going out, there was more harassments on different lakes towards our youth, you know. That's something that probably shouldn't be happening, you know. We have adult white males yelling at our native youth spear fishermen and spear fisher women. And, you know, we don't need that. We don't need that kind of harassment, but it's happening. So.
Mm-hmm. And the governor, Tony Evers, the governor of Wisconsin, issued a statement affirming and reminding the public about treaty fishing rights on that ceded territory. Does that help at all to have that support and message from the governor?
Yeah, I think on some levels it does help, but And in some cases, if you ever read the follow-ups to those social media posts, there's a lot of anti-spearfishing people right on those posts that are so bold. They talk treaty rights down, saying that, you know, they should be null and void because of everything's modernized, and you know, you have all these armchair opinions out there that are floating around. And so, you know, not only is it on the boat landings do we got to deal with this bigoted, racist stuff, but, you know, it's in these public announcements too from our officials. So, you know, this is where we're at today with again with this current administration. You know, we have uneducated people making these statements, and you know, they're getting away with it. They're saying these things, and they're shooting and firing at tribal members. They're throwing rocks. They're harassing. So yeah,
it's
going back in time.
And they might not know about you know, the fish that you catch is eaten by you and your family, and you also are fishing for the elders. Can you talk a little bit more about how important fishing is to you and your tribe and the other tribes that have fishing rights there?
Right. So the fish, you know, when I teach my students, like this morning, I brought some of the freshly speared fish in from last night. I brought those fish in. And I tell the kids, you know, when you see these fish, I'm going to bring these fish out soon. But before we talk about these fish, we got to understand that, you know, when your great grandparents were alive, there was no such thing as a store or McDonald's or markets. You know, they had to live off the land. So these fish, they're not to be caught in the sport way. What happens is these fish are there for Native people to rely on, you know, and it's the best food in the world. And we rely on that. And so when we talk about those fish, we're talking about our grandparents. We want to talk respectfully, and we want to talk highly of those fish. And they prevented us from going hungry. And so when I gave that lesson to those kids, and then when it came time to look at the physical fish out of the bucket, they weren't disturbed by that. They saw a little bit of blood. They saw some of the eggs coming out, and they saw, you know, that, hey, these people are eating this, and these people are taking care of this fish, and these fish are taking care of them. And so we start that relationship and that understanding at a younger age. So that's why we try to teach those lessons in our schools.
Right. We'll be back after this break. We are talking about treaty fishing rights, treaty spear fishing rights in the Midwest. You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848.
The 1995 Oklahoma City bombing shook the nation 30 years ago. The federal building that was targeted also housed a Native housing program. Native people, including law enforcement officials and journalists, are among those who jumped into action to help and to convey the story as it unfolded. We'll talk with some of them on the next Native America Calling.
Challenges to societal harmony abound. Trauma, depression, addiction. In Native communities, these challenges affect nearly everyone. The Native American Social Work Studies Institute educates social workers for careers to address the needs of Native communities. You can be part of the solution as a peer support worker, community health worker, or a counselor with culturally relevant training from the Native American Social Work Studies Institute. Info at online.nmhu.edu. New Mexico Highlands University supports this show.
Yo! Yo! Wee!
You're listening to The Menu on Native America Calling, our special Indigenous food sovereignty show. I'm Andy Murphy, and we're talking with Ojibwe spearfishers today about their treaty rights in ceded territory and ongoing harassment and intimidation they continue to face. You can still join this conversation by calling 1-800-996-2848. That's also 1-800-99-NATIVE. Joining us now from Odena, Wisconsin, is Jason Schlender. He's the executive administrator for the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. He is a Lac-Couturier tribal member. Welcome to The Menu, Jason.
Bonjour. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. You are also a spear fisher, and you went out last night. How did that go?
Well, yeah, it went well. So it's I was over in Minnesota and harvesting off the Mille Lacs Lake last night. Okay. It did well.
All right. So how does the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission help tribal members navigate their rights to spearfish during this time?
So GLIFWIC, or the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission, we were started in 1984. We were established in 1984 as a result of the LCO versus Wisconsin court case, or what is kind of commonly known as the Voight decision, which included some LCO tribal members, or Lac-Couturier tribal members, the Tribble Brothers, an incident that took place in 1974. So years of litigation led to a decision in 1983. And from that decision, the tribes that were the plaintiff tribes, they all basically had to come together to create the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. So our role, we've been active for over 40 years now. We have 11 member tribes from three different states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And our primary role is to ensure safety and the implementation of treaty rights for our 11 member tribes. And so there are federal court orders that we assist the tribes in carrying out. And so, as Biscalcone had mentioned earlier, we do a lot of our agency, our organization. We do a lot of work as far as provide a lot of services for the tribe. So, biological services, enforcement, administrative functions. We also have a division of intergovernmental affairs, public information office, and also a planning and development division as well. And so all of those aspects are services that are provided to the tribe so that they can maximize their harvest and utilize and understand what's most beneficial for them. So there's a lot that goes into what we recognize now as our treaty rights, and so we negotiate agreements between tribes in the state. We also receive our funding through the federal government. So, and that's a way to help implement a lot of those treaty rights practices.
Okay, and I think I mentioned ceded territory, and I don't think we got into that so far in this discussion, but the spear fishing that you and Biscocconi do are in ceded territory. Can you talk about this territory and how it became part of treaty fishing rights?
Sure. So that's the other component of Glyphwick is that there was a number of treaties that the Ojibwe signed that the Ojibwe nations signed with the United States back in 1837, 1842, and 1854, and each one of those treaties specifically designate that the tribes reserve the right to hunt, fish, and gather on land that they had ceded to the United States. So that area of land that was ceded to the United States, we reserve that the capacity to use it. We call it usufructuary right. And so what that is just the ability to use that land because our ancestors had the vision and the foresight to realize that even though that the United States was changing and their lifestyles, our ancestors' lifestyles were changing, abruptly, that they realized that we needed their future generations, ourselves specifically, needed to remain connected to the land and that realizing the resource is what's most important. And so it's documented in our treaty journals that our ancestors thought of us. They knew what was important for us to be able to maintain access to those vital resources, whether that's fish, wild game, wild rice, maple trees, or and just natural things on the earth and from the earth. So that the ceded territory now is the area that Glyphwick helps. They assist or help monitor on behalf of the tribe. So Glyphwick has the delegated authority from the tribes. Those 11 tribes that are part of Glyphwick, those tribes delegate authority to us, to Glyphwick, to help enforce, whether that's having a warden presence or provide safety mechanisms, biological research assessments, and provide public information, education, a number of different services. And so the ceded territory are areas that were ceded to the United States. So and that's in conjunction with the treaties that were signed by the Ojibwe and also the United States government. So each treaty, 37, 42, and 54, have different areas of land that are designated as the ceded territory. So, and that's a really kind of a real complex story, but to narrow it down, both Biscocconi and myself, Lac du Flambeau and Le Coudray, were part of the 1837 ceded territory area. So in those areas there, we utilize off-reservation areas or access off-reservation lakes to harvest. And so that's where Glyphwick comes in to provide those services. Now, individual tribes, Le Coudray and Lac du Flambeau, they possess on-res capacity. So they have their own conservation departments, their own law enforcement, and that's not necessarily that's not Glyphwick's function is to, you know, anything that happens within the exterior boundaries of the reservation, that's not, we don't have the authority to do anything on res is how we explain that or how what's understood with us. So
okay.
These activities that are happening now are all off reservation activities. And so, so that puts us into, as Biscocconi had mentioned, so we're we're not within the confines of our reservation. We go off the reservation into different areas of the ceded territory. So we are oftentimes alone. And so we need, with the volatility of some of our relationships with our border towns, with our reservations, sometimes they are often hostile. So we need a law enforcement presence there to ensure that we're safe, that we can harvest and practice our treaty rights.
Okay. And how did, you know, signing the treaties and the tribes continuing to harvest indigenous food for all those years since the treaties were signed, how did that lead up to the Walleye Wars?
So back when those treaties were signed, there you have to understand history of what was happening at that time. So we'll just take 1837, for example, because that's relevant to what we're saying. Otherwise, this conversation could take multiple days to explain.
Right.
And I want to be thorough, and I want to be, and I want to give, when I talk about our, when I speak of our ancestors, it's to recognize, one, is to recognize their sacrifice of what those things that the incredible burden and the incredible trauma that they were enduring. And so it's, at the same time, it's beautiful at the same time that they thought of us, that they could think of those things because they endured such incredible conditions of living, you know, poverty and discrimination and a lot of those things that were happening, and just genocidal policies that were implemented for the eradication of tribal nations. And that's a fact, right? So the fact that we endured, that we have survived, that we are here now to talk about these things, to reflect on the sacrifice and the love of our ancestors is something that we're really incredibly proud of. And so at that time, with the change of, you know, of what was happening in the United States, the expansion, whether that's recognized as manifest destiny, encroaching into tribal lands, and so when these treaties were signed, I think one of the things that we're told is that our ancestors realized how important the land was for us to remain, and that's a big thing that has transferred forward, is to retain our identity. So in 1837, there is no state of Wisconsin at that time, and so Wisconsin doesn't become a state until 1848. And so once that happens, you know, our treaty, our 37 treaty, is about 11 years old, but there's a lot of miscommunication and ignorance that happens with dispossession and disenfranchisement as far as tribal nations, the Ojibwe, and the residents of Wisconsin. And so what happens as a result is that there are blatant efforts by the state of Wisconsin and the overreaching and authority of their law enforcement to encroach on our treaty rights. Mm-hmm. So it's always been understood that, you know, that our people, that the Ojibwe people that signed those signatories understood that the ceded territory was accessible to them. But the state didn't always understand that, and may have not respected that once statehood was granted to the state of Wisconsin. Once they became part of the Union of the United States. So there was some deliberate attempts by state wardens to harass and kill our tribal members. Mm. And there's documentation of that that goes back over 100 years. And so there was harassment and different things that were taking place a long time before any of these court cases came up. So you fast forward to different moments of time, and there are many different things that we have in our different tribal communities, different people that stood up to be an example, you know, to test to test the law.
Mm-hmm.
Here in Bad River, where I'm at in Odena, there is Chief Blackbird is one of them that, you know, that did that. And what had happened is that when they were confronted by law enforcement, a lot of those things, whether it was whatever they harvested was confiscated. If it was weapons or any of their tools of harvesting were confiscated, and they could have been, oftentimes they were abused physically, and sometimes they were killed. And so that had been going on for a long time, for over a century of just things where a lot of our people were just kind of sneaking around, I guess you could say, and harvesting and doing things because they knew, a lot of our people knew that they could harvest off res, but it was not honored from a state side. So there was a lot of things that were happening, whether it was agents from the BIA,
yeah,
or if it was state wardens that were, I would say, over enforcing some of those things. So there was a number of different instances. So eventually that leads to what I mentioned as far as the incident with the Tribble Brothers. And the Tribble Brothers, just to summarize that real quick, is essentially a test case. They knew that they, in order to challenge the law, they had to be cited. They had to be cited and brought into court, and with that opportunity, they were able to kind of cultivate support from the other tribes. And because all the other tribes had been victims of that harassment for over a century as well, so they just came together to formulate, you know, that plaintiff group, and then they were eventually litigated that case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's kind of like a quick summary of, like, you know, since statehood and the misinterpretation or even the neglect of understanding treaties. And then there's the whole, in 1871, the United States just stops making treaties with tribal nations as a whole. So
right,
there's a misinterpretation there too, that thinking that because they don't make treaties anymore, that are treaties valid or not?
Right.
And so now, so that leads to a lot of different misinterpretation. So what we've seen over the last, I would say, 40 years is that with the, you know, there's been the action of the Tribble Brothers, but also these other things that were taking place too, as far as mobilizing themselves on a tribal level to become lawyers and to become active and preserving our way of life.
All right, we'll be back after this break.
Support provided by Amerind. Amerind is 100% tribally owned and partners with tribes and their businesses to provide affordable commercial insurance coverage, protect tribal sovereignty, and strengthen Native American communities by helping to keep dollars in Indian country. Information about property, liability, commercial auto, and workers' comp available at Amerind.com. That's Amerind.com.
Did you know that one person can save up to 8 lives and heal dozens more through the gift of organ and tissue donation? Give hope to thousands of people across the U.S. waiting for a life-saving organ transplant. Learn more about the power of organ, eye, and tissue donation with Life Center Northwest, the organ procurement organization serving all of Alaska, at lcnw.org. That's lcnw.org.
Support for this program is provided by AARP. AARP creates and connects people to unique tools and programs, helps conserve personal resources, and tackles the issues that matter most to individuals, families, and communities. What AARP does might surprise people. For more information and resources, including member benefits, AARP advocacy, and more, go to aarp.org.
Support provided by Alaska Growth Capital. The Aleut Marketplace is now open. Aleut Corporation shareholders and registered descendants are eligible. Applications are available at alaskagrowth.com under Marketplace.
Skugtash. For more than 40 years, Ramona Farms has revived ancient traditional foods. Tepary beans, pinoli, polentas, and more, all from store.ramonafarms.com. Ramona Farms supports this show. Omnye.
You're tuned to The Menu on Native America Calling. I'm Andy Murphy. And for the remainder of the hour, we're talking about how tribal and Native food programs and projects are being affected by canceled federal funding. Join our conversation with your comments and insights from your Native community. We're at 1-800-996-2848. That's 1-800-99-NATIVE. President Trump has been in office for 100 days, and major changes, cancellations and shrinkages of federal programs and grants have upended a lot of tribal and Native food programs and forced many operators to look elsewhere for funds and or put a stop to their work. Joining us now from Fort Belknap, Montana, is Tesha Hawley. She is the founder and CEO of Day Eagle Hope Project. She's a Ani. Welcome to The Menu, Tesha.
Welcome. Thank you so much for having me today.
So what kind of food work have you been doing in the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation with Day Eagle Hope Project?
Since the start of the COVID pandemic, we started initially by just taking food door to door to each household on a reservation, because at that time our tribe had closed off all access in and out of our reservation, just to try to protect our families and people, especially our elders and the most vulnerable. So our organization started a food pantry, and we started delivering food door to door. And keep in mind, I did not have anything other than an old cop car that was donated to me by our tribe. And I was able to seek or receive some state funding, and I purchased a storage unit, and that's how we started. So from that, we started food pantries around in our community. We have one small one out in the southern part of our reservation, but mainly just because of lack of infrastructure and a building period, we usually just get the food in and we distribute it the same day that we get the We distribute it out to the communities the same day that we receive it.
Okay. And otherwise, Fort Belknap is on a food desert, which means, you know, folks have to drive a long distance to go get to a grocery store to have access to fresh food. And eventually your program was able to gather up some grants and utilize some grants. Tell us how in recent years your food work has been funded by grants.
We've been primarily funded by private donations, private funders, because we are a nonprofit organization. We've received a grant from the state of Montana, which was a LFPFA grant, and that since it had been put on pause, and we have since expended the funds. We receive, you know, just donations from different people, different individuals, and our tribe itself, I wrote a $2 million grant on behalf of the tribe, and we were funded a USDA grant. However, our 2025 grant award was abruptly terminated. We received literally an email, not even from our direct federal officer, just from someone else higher above in the organization, that our 2025 grant was immediately terminated. And it was very frustrating. We did not have access to our federal partners just to get clarification. Everything was put on hold. I had food ordered, and I had to literally call them and tell them to hold off, that I didn't have any of the funding to pay them. So this has been a really challenging time for our tribe and our community and the people that we serve. And not only that, our organization, because we are a small organization, but we're making every effort to meet the needs of putting food on our families' tables.
Okay. And how much was this grant, and what USDA program is this from?
This is from the USDA Local Food Purchasing Assistance Grant, and the grant was for, I believe it was like $750,000 that we were awarded.
Okay. And you were able to previously purchase food locally. Tell me about that, where some of this food was coming from that was going into the pantries or into the food boxes for the community.
So, you know, this grant was designed really to keep everything local, help the local economies, help grow and foster the local producers. So primarily most of our beef was coming from local farmers and ranchers here in Fort Belknap that sold their product in a local stockyard sale. And then one of the local meat processing plants would process, and then we would buy it and give it back out into the community. We've also been able to access and get funding for the processing and final product of our buffalo meat. So, and a lot of, we were able to purchase some choke cherries, some June berries, you know, at a much smaller scale, but just from local people last year. And we make every effort to buy any local produce that any of our local people are growing. You know, since because a lot of our people here didn't have access to big time operating expenses for big gardens and things like that, we've had to go elsewhere within the state of Montana. And because we do have such a short growing season, it makes things very difficult to grow and maintain throughout the year. So most of our products are coming out of western part of Montana, which is ideal for the growing seasons.
Okay. So now without this grant, what does it look like for you and the food work happening at Day Eagle Hope Project? What does it look like going forward without the grant?
The future of us being able to access funding and grants is very bleak. Honestly, it's going to be very difficult to raise a lot of money. Just for example, one truckload of food costs us over $25,000. And that normally feeds about 200 families. And I, to be honest with you, I'm at a loss for words. I have to refocus and rethink about how I'm going to raise this type of money in already a community where our unemployment rate in the winter exceeds 90%. We are a very poor tribe. We are very isolated, even for the food. Honestly, what's going to happen is people are going to go without. And with adequate food, our diseases are already high. It's only going to get higher, and our mortality rate's going to even get higher. And that's really hard for me to talk about, for our community to talk about, but that's reality, because essentially you are what you eat.
Mm-hmm. All right. I want to bring in another guest who can give us a little bit of a bigger picture. Joining us from Oneida, Wisconsin is Richard Elmhill. He is an associate director of Native Agriculture and Food Systems Investments at the First Nations Development Institute. He's a member of the Oneida Nation of Wisconsin. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the menu.
Andy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. So you're hearing what Tesha is talking about. She's at a loss for words, you know, going forward, trying to keep food in the pantry, wanting to keep supporting the local food economy. What are some of your initial thoughts when you hear stories like Tesha's and you're getting reports back from all the tribes that you're keeping tabs on with your at First Nations Development Institute?
Yeah, we're hearing the same sentiment over and over, you know, across Indian country, where we've built up kind of food distribution programs, sometimes from the ground up, sometimes there's new buildings being established, growing capacities, and to have everything suddenly halted, it kind of brings a shock, you know, not only to that program, but into the community, into the families who need that food. And so, you know, there's other layers of support that we can try to be attuned to, just knowing that other tribes and families are in this position. We can kind of check on each other on the mental health of how everybody's doing, and kind of, you know, get back the planning that needs to happen in order to take that next step forward.
Okay. So this one grant, the Local Food Purchase Assistance Program under the USDA, was authorized by the Biden administration under the American Rescue Plan Act back in 2021. Was it understood then that this program would be temporary or permanent?
So back in 2021, the LFPA program was a response to COVID and getting food out. As we know, like, grocery store shelves were empty. We need to get food out in the community, and this was one way to you know, infuse a lot of funds so that food could be purchased and distributed. It was originally planned to be a temporary program, but a lot of the projects had modeled that, you know, this was a great way to get food to reach large and small and rural and urban populations. It just worked on a lot of layers. And so in 2023, they added more long-term support, you know, signaling that this was just a food program, food distribution program that was working. More recently, Senator Jack Reed from Rhode Island wanted to introduce a law that would make that funding more permanent and long-term. And so it's kind of been on a steadily growing program, and you know, to have it end and a lot of the canceled contracts be so quickly, it's just counterintuitive to what's been happening. Mm-hmm.
What are some ways that you're seeing tribes are trying to make up for the grant funds that were just canceled?
Yeah, so at First Nations, you know, we're a Native-led nonprofit. We do a lot of grant making. We do a lot of work in philanthropy to help advocate for Native communities and Native issues. And so we kind of understand, you know, that it takes a lot of work inside that grant cycle to, you know, come up with a plan, put the cost to it, locate what kinds of resources you're going to need, and then go pitch those to different organizations or even the federal funding sources. So a lot of tribes are in a position where if they've lost funding, they're having to pull from their tribal contributions or discretionary funds to cover those costs, and it just creates a gap from wherever they pulled that from. And so you're having to do this work twice. And I know from, you know, just listening to a lot of our grantees, when you're awarded a sizable grant, you know, that's something to celebrate. And so when it's not being honored, that agreement, it's really kind of twofold of having something taken away.
Okay. How are states responding and maybe stepping in to help fill some of these gaps for tribes?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. There are some state-level supports, both that have supported tribes, those with relationships for the food programming. So like in Wisconsin, there's been an additional support for our Tribal Elder Food Box program that supports all 11 tribes in Wisconsin. However, I don't think like each tribe has that level of support from the state. Additionally, the states have also lost funding due to the LFPA cuts, so they're not receiving as much resources through that program. And so I think it's a mixed bag, you know, as I look at it nationally.
Okay. All right. And, you know, so far we've been talking about this LFPA grant or program, the Local Food Purchase Assistance Program under the USDA. But what other federal funding or program cancellations are affecting tribes and Native communities and the food sovereignty work they are doing and maybe won't continue to do in the future?
Yes, so we can't look at LFPA in isolation. There's a lot of things happening around it that are affecting the food system as it relates to tribal communities. The local food for schools, which is another USDA program, cut $660 million. The Emergency Food Assistance Program, the TFAP program, cut another $500 million, and those were also supposed to support food distribution programs to low-income communities. There's been another cut at the farm-to-school program that kind of targeted like racial or wasteful DEI initiatives. Mm. And so, you know, we're seeing a pattern of cuts that are affecting tribal communities. And if we look farther and farther back into our histories, they're really targeting the tribal food systems, you know, kind of taking away our the way we celebrate our culture, the way it feeds us, and our source of nourishment.
All right. All right, that is all the time we have for our conversation today. I'd like to say thank you to our guests, Tesha Holly, Richard Elmhill, Jason Schlender, and Biskakuni. Join us tomorrow for stories from Native people who witnessed the Oklahoma City bombing 30 years ago.
Support from Dartmouth College hosting its Tribal Leadership Academy July 28th to August 2nd in New Hampshire. Up to 25 new or appointed tribal government leaders and a group of experienced presenters will consider intergovernmental relations, economic development, healthcare, natural resources, and tribal law and order. Dartmouth College will cover the travel and attendance costs. Application available at dartmouthtriballeadershipacademy.com. Application deadline is May 16th, 2025.
Support by AARP. If someone asks you to buy gift cards to pay off debt, it's a scam. Imposters will claim your Social Security number's at risk, or your utility company will stop service due to late payments, or you won the lottery and only need to pay some upfront costs. They'll say the fastest way is to buy gift cards and share the numbers on the back. Anyone who tells you to pay a debt with a gift card is a scammer. More information on gift card scams at aarp.org/giftcards.
Native America Calling is produced in the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, a Native nonprofit media organization. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting with support from the Public Radio Satellite.